Thanks for coming. So the what is this? Okay. There's apparently some delay, but that's fine. Yeah, so the story I'm going to tell you today is in the quantum many-body world. So typically we're thinking about some interacting electrons or atoms. Could be in a piece of solid, or in modern days it could also be in artificial systems that people make to use to make quantum computers. And so roughly there are situations where we understand how the electrons or atoms organize them organize themselves into various collective behaviors, or also known as quantum phases of matter. So these are situations where basically perturbation theory works. So you can think of the electrons as roughly non-interacting, and then you do a little bit of perturbation term by term, and things work beautifully. For example, for alkali metals, so this is what makes up your battery. And then there are other situations where perturbation theory just doesn't work, right? The system is strongly interacting. You can't treat the particles as non-interacting. And then, basically, we need more tools, right? As many as we can, to do something more sophisticated and understand what's going on in this kind of systems. Famous examples include things like high-temperature superconductors or fractional quantum Hall effects, and many more. So roughly, the landscape of quantum phases of matter can be divided into two categories. So this is a very coarse division, but it already tells us a lot. So this is a dichotomy in terms of how much degree of freedom you have if you go to low enough energy, right? So let's say you think about the energy levels of your many-body system, right? So there are two cases. So the first case is relatively simple. This is when you have a ground state, and then the first excited state has an excitation energy above the ground state, which is non-vanishing in the thermodynamic limit, right? So even if you take your system size to be very large, you still have a constant energy gap above the ground state, right? So in this case, if I go to low enough energy or temperature, much lower than this energy gap, then I basically have only one state in my entire Hilbert space, right? There's no interesting degree of freedom left, and things are easier. It's rather manageable. This is the case where, for example, for the ordinary insulator with a band gap, and if I go well below the band gap, things become easy, right? Essentially, you have nothing at low energy. In contrast, there's the other situation where you, no matter how low you go in energy or temperature, there's always something left, right? So this is the case if, for example, there's an entire continuum just above the ground state, right? So the entire thing is gapless. Or maybe you have a situation that looks somewhat similar to this one. So there is a clear gap between excited states and some ground states, but then you have more than one such ground state. And the splitting between the ground state and strictly the first excited state, it's non-zero, but it's vanishing in the thermodynamic limit, where this L is your system size, right? So this left case corresponds to, for example, if I have a metal, and if I have something more modern called topological orders, for example, fractional quantum Hall effect, then we're in this situation, right? And spontaneous symmetry breaking phases like magnets or superfluids, they can go either way, depending on the symmetry being broken is continuous or discrete, right? So in either case, you always have something left at arbitrarily low energy, and the state is considered more interesting, right? In fact, a big chunk of modern condensed matter physics is to try to better understand what can happen with this type of non-trivial phases of matter. How do we understand them? How to classify them? What are the possibilities? So as I said, this is a much coarser classification of phases, right? Because this non-trivial thing contains many different possibilities. But even if I just ask this coarser question, right? I hand you a Hamiltonian, and then I ask, at low energy, do I have nothing, or do I still have something left, right? Even that question is extremely hard in general to answer. So this dichotomy in terms of low energy spectrum can also be formulated in a slightly more modern way, inspired by thinking in quantum information theory. So essentially, instead of looking at the low energy spectrum, I can just look at the ground state wave function. So it turns out the ground state wave function alone already knows a lot about what happens at low energy, right? Without looking at any of the excited states. So what people realize over the past couple of decades, let's say, is that the difference between this nothing versus something from the last slide can be formulated as the difference between the so-called short versus long-range many-body entanglement. Right? So if I look at my ground state, let's say think about a spin system for concreteness. Right? So the simplest possible state, the wave kind of wave function you can write on this kind of spin system is just an unentangled tensor product state. Right? So I have my first spin pointing up, for example, second spin pointing down, et cetera. Okay, I guess most people would agree that this kind of state should be considered trivial. And then on top of that, I can perform a finite depth unitary quantum circuit. So essentially, I perform a unitary circuit where each box here represents some local gates involving nearby qubits, right? And then each layer consists of commuting gates, and then I perform this gate this circuit layer by layer. And by a shallow, I demand that this depth of the circuit, which is the number of layers, to be much smaller than my system size. Right? Very often we think of them as a constant in the large system size limit. But sometimes you can do they can grow logarithmic in system size. That's fine. But in any case, it's much smaller than the system size. So if I get a state, I can prepare the state using this way, using this finite depth or shallow depth local unitary circuit, starting from an unentangled product state, then I call this state, this state is called short-range entangled state, right? And it was realized that if I have a unique gapped ground state of a local Hamiltonian, which is what I called nothing in the previous slide, this should be considered, the ground state is a short-range entangled state. And anything else is called long-range entangled. Basically, if I have a long-range entangled state, it's the opposite. If I try to prepare this state starting from an unentangled product state and using some local unitary circuit, the depth has to be very large, has typically comparable to your system size. Right? So if I have, let's say, a metal or a spontaneous symmetry breaking state, typically that's the case. So that's short versus long-range entanglement. But as I said, if I just give you a Hamiltonian, it's in general very hard to tell whether my ground state is long or short-range entangled. That requires me to, in general, that requires me to solve the ground state, which is a hard thing. So it would be nice if there could be some kinematic constraint, right? Something, general about the structure, which is relatively easy to know. Right. And starting from that, it can already constrain what kind of state you can get, in particular whether you can get a short-range entangled state at all. Right. Such statement would be very powerful, but it turns out you've all seen such a statement in your undergrad solid state textbook or high school chemistry if you're fancy. So this is the statement in solid state 101, which is that if I have electrons in a periodic crystal, let's say it sees a periodic potential, then this kind of system can form an insulator, which is what I call nothing, right? A short-range entangled unique gapped ground state, only if the number of electrons per unit cell is an integer. Right? So in textbook, this is derived very easily from free fermion theory. So because in free fermion theory, you solve the band structure, you fill up your single particle levels till the chemical potential, and if you want an insulator, you want to completely fill some integer number of bands, and each band gives you an integer, basically one for a particle per unit cell. So if you have an insulator, you're guaranteed to have an integer number of electrons per unit cell. Right? So it's a very simple statement from solid state. But what's amazing is that this statement itself is actually much deeper than just that. Right? It turns out this statement, right, meaning you cannot have a trivial state if the electron density is not an integer, is true even for interacting system. Right? So the non-trivial thing is for interacting system, let's say if your Hamiltonian looks like this, then in general, you can't really solve the ground state. It's really hard to do that. But you know this is true as long as you satisfy two conditions. The first condition is that your Hamiltonian is local, right? So if I write it this way, this two fermion term and this four fermion term, I can have even more complicated, like six fermion, eight fermion, doesn't matter. But each term is non-vanishing only if they only involve nearby, they involve only nearby fermions, right? For example, this IJKL here, these are labels of your lattice site. They must be close to each other. So your Hamiltonian is local. And then there's the second condition, which is you have the right symmetry. So you have the U1 charge conservation and the lattice translation, so z to the d, where d is your space dimension. Right? So you have this two symmetries unbroken, which makes a lot of sense, right? Because you need your U1 symmetry to define what you mean by number of electron, and you need translation symmetry to define what you mean by unit cell. So these are very sensible conditions. So these are very generous conditions. So as long as you meet them, the statement is that your ground state must be long-range entangled, right? If the number of electrons per unit cell is not an integer, right? So this was first proved by Lipschultz-Matisse like in the 60s, and later refined and vastly generalized by many people: Oshikawa, Hastings, and many others, right? So this kind of kinematic constraint, where you only need to know something, you know, global, something very general about the system, not the full detail of your interaction, and then you can say something non-trivial about the structure of your ground state or any state, in fact. This kind of constraints, I'll loosely call them quantum anomaly, for this talk. So I talked about electrons. Well, it turns out, you know, as I said, this theorem has been generalized to many different situations. So one situation I want to say a little bit more is you don't have to talk about electrons. You can just talk about spins, right? Just think about a quantum spin system, right? Which is appropriate if you want to think about magnetism in an insulator. So if now I have a lattice of spins with, again, I demand translation symmetry. But let's say I also have some SO3 spin rotation symmetries, right? So think about a lattice. On each side, I have a spin moment, and the SO3 symmetry rotates the spins. And imagine a case where the spin per unit cell, or just spin per site, is a half integer. Right? Let's say one half. I have one qubit per site. That's the simplest situation. And again, Hamiltonian is local and symmetric. For example, I can have this Heisenberg S dot S coupling between close by spins, or I can have something crazier, like I can involve four spins, six spins, it doesn't matter, as long as it's local, right? In this situation, again, there is the famous Lipschultz-Matisse theorem that states that my ground state, in fact, any state that's symmetric under this condition, cannot be gapped and unique. It must be long-range entangled, basically. So I'm not going to show you the proof, but there's some simple way to make sense of it, right? For example, think about the simplest case. Think about a 1D lattice. You have this chain of spin half moments, right? A qubit chain, and you say, okay, I don't believe this theorem. Let me try to cook up some counterexample. Right. So a counter example would be a short range entangled state which is symmetric under the symmetry. The simplest short range entangled state is just a product state. So you just make a product state. Well, the problem is if you make a product state, then any qubit has to be in a definite state. But these are spin half moments. So, you know, for example, you put everything in spin up, well, that immediately breaks the SO3 rotation symmetry for you. So that's no good. Or you can do something a little bit more sophisticated. For example, you know that it takes two qubits or two spin halves to form a singlet. So let's do that. Let's take this the first spin and second spin form a singlet, this up, down, minus, down, up. The third and fourth form a singlet, fifth and sixth, and so on. This way, the state is SO3 symmetric. The problem is you stare at this pattern, it breaks translation symmetry. Right? You translate this picture by one unit cell, it's a different picture. Right? So you can try harder and harder until you realize one day that no matter how hard you try, as long as your state is short-range entangled, there's no way for you to satisfy the symmetry. So as I said, this has many generalizations. For example, you can replace SO3 basically by a pretty general group G. And this condition of half integer spin is phrased as having a projective representation of G in every unit cell. So essentially, the group algebra is satisfied on the state only up to some phase factor. All right, so I've told you two kinematic constraints on the lattice. There is another example which superficially look quite different. This is when you have what we call a topological insulator and you go to the boundary. So a topological insulator is almost by definition something that, let's say if I have a 3D piece of material that is a topological insulator, you go into the bulk of that insulator, it looks boring. Right? It looks like you have a unique gapped ground state. There's no interesting degree of freedom left if I go to low enough energy. However, if I go to the boundary of this three-dimensional funny thing, the boundary is guaranteed to be interesting. Right? For the standard topological insulator, what happens is that if I go to the boundary is actually metallic. There is an emergent gapless Dirac fermion that shows up at the boundary of this thing. And the non-triviality of this metallic boundary state is guaranteed as long as my U1 charge conservation and time reversal symmetry, so some symmetry, is preserved. Right? So the system looks very different from the lattice, Lipschitz-Martis I told you in the previous two slides. But the statement smells very similar. Right? There is some symmetry there. I want to preserve the symmetry. And then there are some kinematic constraint. In the previous slide, it's formulated in terms of some representation of the group or the total charge. Here is the statement that is on the surface of a topological insulator. But in any case, if I have this kind of constraint, if I satisfy this kinematic condition, then my state is guaranteed to be interesting. That's the common flavor here. So in modern time, people realized that thanks to the work of many people, I think this might be the first one pointing out, that these kinematic constraints are more or less the same thing. Right? There is a unified way to think about them. So for this talk, when I say anomaly, what I mean is some kinematic obstruction of having trivial states, having short-range entangled states. It turns out this notion is roughly equal to the notion of what's known as the Tu-Hoft anomaly from quantum field theory. The idea is that by having a Tu-Hoft anomaly, the theory itself may look fine. I have my theory with some dynamical degree of freedom. That may look fine. But then when I try to couple my theory to a gauge field, I cannot do it consistently. Right? There's an obstruction for me to couple my theory to a gauge field. Unless that gauge field also lives in a higher dimensional bulk, right, where my actual system is viewed as the boundary of this bulk. So for the case of topological insulator, this bulk is really literally the bulk of my insulating material. And for the case of the lattice system I talked before, this bulk is a more abstract notion. But in any case, you can think of all these things in a rather unified way. So this is a beautiful picture and provides powerful calculational tools. Actually, you can do it a lot of things with it. But for most of the rest of the talk, I won't emphasize this point of view too much, partly because the meaning of this approximately equal sign is sometimes a little bit subtle. For example, it may be a little bit subtle to define exactly what I mean by couple my theory to a gauge field. If I have a field theory, it's usually manageable, but know, I'm very often talking about lattice system and so on. So there, it's one has to be a little bit careful. So I will avoid those subtleties by not talking about this too much, except for the very last part of my talk, actually. So instead, I'll focus on some new examples of kinematic constraints, which we've discovered over the past few years, and how they, formulated in terms of some rather general condition that guarantees my system to be interesting. Okay. All right, so here's the outline of the rest of the talk. So I'll cover two recent examples of essentially new types of kinematic constraints or anomaly. So the first one is it's very similar to the Lipschitz-Matisse constraint I mentioned, right? So remember there, the important ingredient is lattice translation symmetry and some internal symmetry. It could be U1 charge conservation or SO3 spin rotation. Turns out we've discovered a version of that that only requires lattice translation, so nothing else. So it's in some sense a slightly more basic or fundamental version of the Lipschitz-Matisse. Then I'll move to something that looks totally different. I move to a situation where you don't have translation symmetry. You have disorders or impurities in your system, and then it's a disorder system. Translation symmetry is not a good symmetry unless you average over all disorder realization. Right? So there's some sense of average symmetry, and then there is, turns out, a sense of average anomaly. We can talk about an average Lipschitz-Matisse. So that's the second example. And then toward the end, I'll mention briefly how we can actually leverage this power of anomaly to help us actually discover new quantum phases that people didn't conceive before. Okay. So first, constraints from translation alone. This is a work done with a former student Lei Yang in this paper. So the central result is just rather simple theorem. The theorem is this. So let's consider a lattice system. Could be a lattice spins or could be fermions. Doesn't really matter. In arbitrary dimension, it isn't higher than equal to one. And the statement is if I have a short-range entangled state, let me remind you, defined as a state that can be prepared from a trivial product state, let's say all spins being zero. Using a shallow depth local unitary circuit, right? So it's prepared with using a circuit with a depth d much smaller than the system size L, right? And if this short-range entangled state psi happens to be an eigenstate of the translation operator, right? If I translate it, I get back to my own the original state up to a phase factor. Then this eigenvalue, which is basically e to the I times momentum. Right. That's the definition of momentum. Then this eigenvalue must be 1. Namely, momentum has to be 0. This is for spins, for fermions. It turns out you can be plus minus 1. But the point is it's some very trivial looking number you're getting. Right. So another way to phrase this theorem is to say that if on this system I have a many-body state psi, that's an eigenstate of translation operator with a many-body momentum that's not trivial. It's a momentum that's not zero. Right? Then this state has to be long-range entangled. Right? If you try to prepare this from a product state, you need a circuit depth of order your system size. Or if you realize this state as the ground state of your Hamiltonian, the ground state must be gapless. That's the statement. Right? So in terms of a slogan, it's saying that a non-zero momentum requires long-range entanglement. Right. So, all right. So I'm not going to show you how to derive this result. For that, you can check out our paper. But I'm going to tell you some intuition that hopefully you will, by the end you will think that it makes a lot of sense. Right? It more or less has to be true. So let's think about intuitively how this could be true for. Let's say if I have a lattice of spins. Now, the statement is a short-range entangled state has to have zero momentum. Well, the simplest short range entangled state, again, is just a product state. So let's think about product states. Right, so if I have a product state, by definition, it's some A1 tensor A2 and so on. Let's say A1, A2 could be spinning up and down and so on. If I act on this state with a translation operator, the definition is that this A1 goes to A2, A2 goes to A3, and so on. And L is my system size, right? So essentially, I have a ring and I move it by one unit cell. Well, if you stare at this form of action, the only eigenstate under translation is this thing, where every A takes the same state, right? It's just A tensor A tensor A. Let's say all speed pointing up. But then, trivially, this state has zero momentum, right? You just translate it. Not only is it an eigenstate, it's an eigenstate with eigenvalue 1. And there's nothing else you can do, really, right? It's either not an eigenstate or has eigenvalue 1. So a product state cannot have non-trivial momentum, right? The non-trivial part of our theorem is that it's really saying that you can hit on this product state with a low-depth quantum circuit, and the conclusion doesn't really change. Right? Essentially, a low-depth circuit cannot boost your momentum by any non-trivial amount. Now you can also cook up, you know, some state that has non-trivial momentum. Right? For example, this guy. You can think about 0, 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, minus 1, 0, 1, 0, 1, 0. Right? That's an easy one. That's an antiferromagnet. And if you translate this guy, this guy goes to this guy, so you get a phase factor of minus 1. So it has a momentum pi. But this cat state, this GHZ state, is long-range entangled. Right? You can see it in multiple ways. You measure the connected two-point correlation function. It's non-vanishing in long distance, so violating the cluster decomposition. Or if you realize this state as the ground state of an antiferromagnetic Hamiltonian, then this state has to be degenerate with another state, which is 0, 1, 0, 1, plus 1, 0, 1, 0, because right? These two states are locally indistinguishable. In particular, if you try to prepare this state out of a trivial product state using a local unitary circuit, the circuit depth is known to be at least of order, the system size. Right, so that's the intuition for bosons. I can give you another intuition for fermions, which is the argument looks very different. So again, just intuitively, let's think about the simplest kind of fermion states, the free fermion states. Right? I'm pulling out this picture again. If I have a short-range entangled state for free fermion, that just means a band insulator. Right? And again, I'm just filling up some integer number of bands. But then the total moment, the many-body momentum is just the summation of all the momentum of each occupied state, right? But if I filled up an entire band, then I'm summing over momentum in my entire Brillouin zone. Then you can do a simple calculation it's simple enough to see that the result you get will either be zero, has to be either zero or pi. Essentially, any momentum k has a minus k, which cancel each other, and then the summation is always trivial. Okay. The only way you can get something that's not zero is by partially filling a band, let's say, in an asymmetric way. Let's say you have a Fermi surface whose left Fermi momentum and right Fermi momentum are not the same. Okay. And then you sum over this momentum, you can get an arbitrary number. But by having that, you are having a metal. Because you have a Fermi surface with gapless excitation and all that. Of course, the non-trivial part of our theorem is then saying that this is the conclusion is valid even beyond the free fermion picture. Okay. So that's intuition number two. Right, so that's what I want to say about making sense of this theorem. Another thing I want to say is, as I mentioned, you know, this theorem doesn't rely on having a U1 charge conservation or spin SO3 rotation. So, the statement smells a lot like the usual Lipschitz matrix, right? But with less symmetry. So it feels like it's probably a slightly more basic version of the Lipschitz matrix. And indeed, that's true in a rather precise sense. So let me just to show you as an implication of our theorem. If you accept our theorem, my claim, then it turns out the Lipschitz matrix for the U1 cross lattice translation case can be derived quite easily. So this is the only This is the only thing I'm going to derive for you in this talk, because I feel it's simple enough. Okay? So again, let's go back to this solid state 101 example. Right? Think about a 1D lattice system. You have U1 charge conservation and lattice translation. And again, charge per unit cell is Q over L is not an integer. And so Q is my total charge. Now, the LSM is saying that any symmetric state, and symmetric under this symmetry, must be long-range entangled. Let me get you a simple proof. The proof is that, well, it's symmetric, so it's an eigenstate of translation. Now, there are two possibilities. One is the eigenvalue, the momentum p, is not zero. Then by our theorem, this is a long-range entangled state. Right? So we're done. Then the other case is if the momentum of this psi is zero. Okay, then our theorem doesn't directly say anything immediately. But then you can consider a slightly different state, which is this psi acted on by this operator. This is e to the I 2 pi x over L times, so x is the lattice side index. Right? It goes from 1, 2, 3, all the way to L, the system size. Right? And qx is the charge density operator at position x. Right? So what does this operator do? Well, if I think about a single particle state, right? A single particle by definition has q equal to 1. So if I have a single particle state, this operator is basically multiplying my wave function with a plane wave with a momentum 2 pi over L for a single particle. And then if I have many particles, each single particle gets a momentum boost by 2 pi over L. So the total many body state get a momentum boost by 2 pi q over L. Right? Okay, you can do it a little bit, you can do it more rigorously, but you'll get the same result. The statement is that this psi prime compared to psi has a momentum being boosted by 2 pi q over L. But q over L is just my electron density, my charge density, right? Which by assumption is not an integer, which means this momentum boost is not an integer multiple of 2 pi. So it's a non-trivial momentum, right? Which by our theorem means that this psi prime has to be long-range entangled. And then the thing is, the original psi and psi prime only differ by a very simple unitary operator. So this is an operator that's like a one-layer quantum circuit, and each gate is literally acting only on one side. Right? This gate at different x, because q at different x, they commute. Right? So it's literally just a one-layer thing. So they only differ by depth one unitary. Which means if psi prime is long-range entangled, psi is also long-range entangled. So that's the end of the proof, right? Whether p is zero or not, this psi has to be long-range entangled. Okay? So that's the proof of the first lesson in solid state 101.
Sorry, but the nature of long-range entanglement is different from the GHZ state.
It doesn't specify, right? Because here you can have a charge density wave that will also satisfy this. Right. The idea is it only tells you it's long-range entangled. It could be a Fermi surface. It could be a charge density wave. It could be a superconductor. Yeah. That's also the case for the usual LSM. Yeah. Okay. So that's a case with exact lattice translation symmetry. So now let me move to a seemingly completely different territory. Let me think about a situation where the lattice translation is not there because I have some disorders or impurities and so on, right? But then I can talk about average symmetry and define the notion of average anomaly, average LSM, and then see what they tell us. First, why bother thinking about disorder system, right? The crucial thing is, for real material, exact translation symmetry is a lie, right? Because you always have things like impurity, your lattice defect, and so on. For example, you tried very hard to make a crystal out of certain type of atom, but then you can't stop some other atom to hopping from time to time. You can try your best, but they'll always be there. Right? So for a particular realization of your material, this translation symmetry is not there. But it may be realistic to assume that the probability for this beaver to hop in is the same from site to site, right? It has the same probability to appear here compared to appear here or here, right? So there is a sense of average translation symmetry, at least quite to a reasonable degree, even for real materials, right? Then the natural question is, do the notion of, do average symmetries offer some interesting kinematic constraints of a similar nature, as I mentioned before, right? Of course, the broader motivation is, you can also say that we're trying to extend the scope of what we mean by symmetries in quantum matter, right? If I think about disorder systems, which are usually very hard to understand, can we understand the kinematics better, right? By thinking about the symmetry seriously. So let me be a little bit more concrete. Again, let's think about a spin system, right? By now, our old friend. Let me think about a spin chain, just for concreteness, right? With I impose SO3 symmetry with, let's say, spin half per unit cell. So again, a qubit chain with SO3 symmetry. I think about local Hamiltonians. I can have nearest neighbor Heisenberg interaction or some other local interaction. Doesn't matter. The only difference with the previous case is that these coupling constants J are drawn randomly from a probability distribution. Okay. So the important point is the distribution at different sites, they are more or less independent. Let's say, just for simplicity, they are independent. And the distribution function itself is translationally symmetric. So the probability distribution for Jij is the same as that for ji plus r, j plus r for any integer r, for example. So you have this average translation symmetry. But if I only look at a single disorder realization, a particular set of jij, then you don't have that symmetry. Your Hamiltonian doesn't look translation invariant. And for that reason, doesn't have to be a translation eigenstate. In general, it won't be. Then you can ask, do you have similar things like LSM? Right. Again, you can try to cook up with a simple boring state, see if they can satisfy the rule of gain, meaning the symmetry. Again, a totally trivial product state won't do the job because it breaks spin SO3. Now you can try this guy a little bit more seriously. But then the problem is, if you just form nearest neighbor singlets, this picture still breaks translation symmetry quite badly. And then you say, okay, look, I don't actually have the full translation symmetry. So maybe from time to time, I allow me to break up some singlet bond and forming some slightly longer range singlet bond and try to avoid that. Well, it turns out if you want to do this kind of thing to satisfy the lattice translation symmetry, you need to have singlet bonds that are arbitrarily long. So if you do the combinatorics right, this is what you will find. So basically, it's hard to write down a state that's even averagely symmetric. It turns out this can be turned into a theorem. Again, I won't show you the proof, but I'll at least tell you the statement. Right? So this is work done with, again, a former student, Rochen Ma. So the idea, the statement is that for a single realization, right? Because the single realization can break translation symmetry quite badly. There's no, the previous Lipschultz-Matisse theorem doesn't actually apply. So a priori, there's nothing really stopping me from having a short-range entangled ground state. So if I just draw a single state psi out of the ensemble, my disorder ensemble, there is a chance that it is short-range entangled. But the statement is that the probability for such a thing to happen vanishes in the thermodynamic limit, right? Particular, if I think about the correlation length of the state, if you want to be careful, you can define the correlation length as the circuit depth you need to create the state out of a trivial product state. Right? In any case, the correlation length, the probability for the correlation length to stay finite as your system size becomes larger and larger will vanish. Right? So if you go to a large enough system size, almost all your, pretty much all your states have arbitrarily long correlation length. So essentially, we've derived an average version of the Lipschitz-Matisse, where you only need the average translation symmetry. And the conclusion is that this, your ensemble should be almost certainly long-range entangled. So that's the conclusion we derived. So more generally, what we found is that Tu-Hoff anomaly can be defined for average symmetries. So, you know, this powerful notion of Tu-Hoff anomaly, which we've been using a lot for clean system, actually at least do make sense for this disordered systems. And if the anomaly is non-trivial, typically what it tells us is that your states are almost certainly long-range entangled in this sense. Okay. So looking forward a little bit, the original motivation, at least for me, to think about this disorder anomaly and disorder LSN is the following situation in modern condensed matter physics, which is there is a class of, or a huge class of quantum material. Let me call them disordered quantum critical systems. Right? They appear quite frequently in the lab. For example, you can have quantum Hall phase transitions, superconductor insulator transitions, metal insulator transitions, and many, many more, right? And they've been discovered in the lab for decades, right? So all these things were first discovered in the last century, actually. But they remain poorly understood even till today. Right? The reason is once you have this strong disorder and strong interaction together, there's very little you can do. Perturbation theory typically works really badly, and we don't really know too much about what else you can do, except for a few isolated cases. So what we realized over the past few years is that, you know, forget about the dynamics. Even the kinematics has actually not been properly understood, right? So maybe, you know, at least let's first really understand the kinematics well enough first, and get all the constraints right. And it's been known that that approach works pretty well for clean system, right, for quantum critical states in clean system, or just quantum field theory in general. So hopefully, with a bit of more effort, we can gain some mileage from the kinematic aspect, even on this disordered interacting systems, which tend to be very challenging. Okay, so that's the disorder part. So in the last bit of the time, let me, you know, these two are new kinematic constraints we've derived, right, recently. The other thing which we can do is that, you know, the anomaly tells us the state has to be non-trivial, but it tells us actually a little bit more than that. It tells us that this state has to be non-trivial in certain specific ways, right? So we can actually leverage that with the anomaly and some other tools we have to discover new quantum phases that that were not there before. So strategy-wise, this is something very familiar in field theory context. It's known as anomaly matching. The idea is you have your system, your UV system. It can be a field theory, but it doesn't have to. It can be a lattice system or something like that, where it's well defined. You know your Hilbert space. You know your symmetry. You know your anomaly. Right? All these things can be well defined. Here, by anomaly, let me go back to this two-hoofed picture, where anomaly is defined as essentially the effective action of your background gauge field in the bulk. Right? It's some well-defined thing. Right? That's the important thing. The point is any theory, so you have a system, and then any theory out of that system has to match that anomaly. Right? So by theory here, it can be some IR effective field theory. That's very often the case. But it doesn't have to, again. We're talking about lattice system. You know, maybe the IR is not a field theory, but that's totally fine. But at least you can still talk about the ground state wave function, Or maybe your system may be an open system. You may be coupling to a bath, in which case you don't even want to talk about a single pure state. Maybe you want to talk about a density matrix. But in any case, it's a theory, right? Something. The important point is that theory has to, well, first of all, it has to have the right symmetry, because it comes from a system with the symmetry. But the important thing is it also has to have the right anomaly. Right? Oops. Ah. That's an accident. But it has to have the right anomaly. So the strategy is basically, instead of solving this thing, let's say you start from a UV system, try to solve your Hamiltonian or something, or if it's an open system, solve your Gimbalian, which is even a more messy thing, to find the ground state or the density matrix, you just try to find some theory that matches the anomaly. Sometimes even this task is complicated enough that if you find a solution, there's a good chance that it may mean something. Right? So that's the strategy. You just find IR stuff that has the right anomaly. The point is not all non-trivial state will have the right anomaly. So you have to pick among all the non-trivial state which state has the right anomaly. Right? Just as this great man once said, all trivial states are alike, and on each non-trivial state is non-trivial in its own way.
But original statement is, all happy families are alike.
Yeah.
All unhappy families are unhappy in their own way.
Yeah. That's I would say that's the paraphrase of this thing. Right. So now I'm going to show you a few examples. The idea is not to give you any detail of any sort, but just to give you a taste, right, a rough idea of how widely applicable this line of thinking can be. Right? So a few examples. The first example, this was done with again with Lei and our Anton, is if I can think about a Wilson metal. A semi-metal is something, loosely speaking, in between insulator and a metal. So what's interesting about this Wilson metal is that it's some electronic state where if I go to low enough energy, the dispersion of your electrons looks like some gapless Weyl fermions. That's in 3+1 dimension. Right? And they have interesting property, and they've been literally realized in the lab. They are actual piece of material that does literally that. Right? Essentially, by thinking seriously about the anomaly of this particular state and asking what are some of the other interesting things that match this anomaly, we notice that in principle, there is a different state that matches exactly the same anomaly, but it's not a free fermion state anymore. It's some strongly interacting state. In particular, it's actually gapped. So you can view that as a three-dimensional analog of a fractional quantum Hall state with interesting property, right? For example, it's a three-dimensional topological order, so it has not only particle excitation, but like loop-like excitation. And the funny thing is if I link that loop with a lattice defect, let's say a lattice dislocation in particular, then there are funny braiding properties, right? If I take this loop and braid with another loop, where when they are both linked to a dislocation, there are funny phase factors happening, and it turns out that's the manifestation of the anomaly in the Wilson metal. So that's for electronic semi metal. Another example is in the world of quantum magnetism. This is a very different world. Again, the Wilson metal is in 3D. This guy is in 2D. What we found is that if you start from certain type of magnetic order, these are called non-coplanar magnetic order. Let's say you take some lattice, for example, this triangle lattice. You arrange your spin moments in this funny pattern, right? And then you introduce quantum fluctuation. You let the order fluctuate In fact, you let the order fluctuate so strongly that eventually the order is destroyed due to quantum fluctuation. The funny thing is, under appropriate conditions, there's something non-trivial left, right? Because if you destroy the order, the anomaly, this system has some non-trivial anomaly. It's in fact the Lipschitz-Matisse type of anomaly. The anomaly guarantees that whatever that's left cannot be too trivial, right? And in fact, what can happen is that you can a brand new state, which we call stifle liquid, could appear here. So this is some long-range entangled state with gapless dispersions and so on, with many exotic property. Nothing look, essentially doesn't look like anything that that people have found before in quantum magnetism. And they can arise. And this was discovered through essentially anomaly matching. Right? So this is work with a bunch of PI folks. Liu Jun is postdoc here. Wei Chen was a former student, and our Ying Chen. So that's quantum magnetism. It's a very different world. And there is a third example, which again looks totally different from previous two. Now let's talk about open system, right? Again, as I said, don't talk about pure state in an open system. You should talk about a density matrix, right? The question is, can we find interesting density matrices? But just assisted by anomaly. This is a very recent work with Leo, our student here, and Meng Cheng from Yale. So the statement is this. The claim is there is a very simple looking density matrix that's long range entangled. So the system is, again, a qubit chain. It's been half chain. For this talk, everything is about qubit chain, if you like. The density matrix is this guy. It's identity plus this guy. So this x is the Pauli x operator. So you multiply all the Pauli x operators together. And then this cz is the control z gate between two qubits, between the I and I plus one qubit. Control z meaning it's diagonal in the z basis. It's plus one for everything, except if both spins are pointing down. Right? When they are both pointing down, it's minus one. Otherwise, it's just plus one. So it's, in the z basis, it's just a phase factor. So what's funny is that this xcz, or sometimes called czx operator, is actually correspond to a symmetry action of an anomalous z2 symmetry. Right? This was figured out quite a while ago. So this density matrix is really just projecting to the subspace of your Hilbert space with eigenvalue under this CZX operator plus one. Right? So if you like, it's like an infinite temperature state subject to the constraint that you have the symmetry eigenvalue plus one. It's like an infinite state in a canonical ensemble, if you like. Now, turns out we worked out in this paper the consequence of this anomaly. It's something really funny, because this state has the funny property that if I take my system, sorry. If I consider a tripartition of my system, right? If I have my system as A, B, C, then this state is long-range entangled, right? In the sense that I cannot think of my state as a collection of pure states where each state is disentangled on A, B, C. It's some state on A, tensor direct product, state on B, tensor state on C. Right? So there is some tripartite entanglement between any tripartition A, B, C. And that feature is robust even against certain finite depth local unitary. So it's some universal feature. But the state is actually bipartite separable, meaning that for any bipartition, let's say A versus BC or B versus AC, doesn't matter, so A and A bar, this state is actually separable. You can write it as a collection of states, of pure states. Each pure state is just A tensor A bar. Okay. So this is something that's possible for mixed state only, because for a pure state, if it's bipartite separable, for any bipartition, it's trivial to see that it will be tripartite separable automatically. But somehow this state is not, and in a rather universal manner, right, in a many-body sense. So this row is actually intrinsically a mixed, but intrinsically long-range entangled state. Right? If you think about it, it's funny. Beside this funny constraint, it's really an infinite temperature state. Normally, that kind of state is considered pretty classical, pretty boring. But just with this single constraint alone, you got this interesting quantum mechanical entanglement. And in fact, to see this statement, this anomaly argument is the simplest. There are like dozens of tripartite entanglement measures for mixed state in the literature. None of them work really well for this particular state. So anomaly really buys you something here. All right. So let me summarize. The main message is anomaly is good. Right. So it gets you kinematic constraints, and nice thing is it guarantees that your state is going to be interesting, so it's worth studying. At many applications, as I mentioned, you have this non-zero momentum requires long-range entanglement. You have the average LSM where in a disorder system, it still guarantees your state to be almost always non-trivial. You can use that to discover a bunch of new phases. You can talk about gap wild semi-metal, the stifle liquid, which is one of my personal favorite, and then this long-range entangled weird mixed state. So let me finish with the most important slide. It's been fortunate for me to work with a bunch of brilliant collaborators. I should particularly highlight this cohort of young folks at PI. So Liu Jun is our postdoc, who's moving to National U of Singapore as a faculty. Ro Chen is moved on to at U Chicago. These are students. Ro Chen moved on to Chicago. Lei moved on to Caltech. Wei Chen to UB, British Columbia. Liu is the only one here now. Hang on there. I've been having a lot of fun collaborating with the other folks at PI, so Anton and Yin Chen. On this story with disordered and mixed state stuff, I've been having a lot of fun with this group of people. So Jian Hao is a postdoc at Penn State with Zhen Bi and Meng from Yale. So let me just stop there and thank you for attention.
When you derive the LSM theorem from the translation invariance, how do you distinguish integer and half integer space?
Now this is for U1. Yeah, this is for U1.
Ah, I see.
Of course, you sort of can. If you want to talk about the SO3 case, you can look at the U1 subgroup. It will work the same way. Being spin half basically says your Q over L has to be a half integer.
Thanks for a very nice talk. About the disorder average.
Yeah.
You mentioned about average symmetry.
Yeah.
The context of Anderson localization.
Yeah.
Without talking about average symmetry, people talk about average Green's function. So
yeah.
If you take calculate the Green's function formally exactly and average it, and it loses all the information. Instead, if you average G star G, then it has all the sharp information, like mobility edge and so on.
Yeah.
So there may be some connection between your approach and that.
Yeah, I've been thinking about similar kind of thing. For disorder system, a lot of the art is about which stage you should take the average.
Exactly.
Yeah. So now, as formulated in this way, it doesn't directly connect to that. But I'm thinking about how you can connect. Yeah. The idea is for example, naively one may say, okay, this may mean that maybe your two-point function after disorder average should be long range like power law. That's not true in general. In some specific cases it is, but not in general it's not. But I have some conjecture that maybe some higher moment thing. If you take the two-point function and then you take the square of that and then average, that may be guaranteed to be power law. Something of that sort. I haven't been able to actually prove it fully, but I think something of that sort will be correct.
Yeah, one of this short general question. We talked about anomaly matching.
Yeah.
Infrared.
Yeah.
Is it possible only through lattice regularization, or you can do it in other contexts where there is no lattice?
Oh, I mean.
Cut off.
Usually. Oh, sorry. Usually, when field theorists do this, there's no lattice. It's a field theory, UV, field theory in IR. Okay, maybe UV is a string theory or something. Yeah. So the. The more recent thing is that the UV can be a lattice, but of course you can imagine other things. I don't know, Yingchen is not here, but you can think about a lambda level, and it's actually a very fun question of how do this make sense in a lambda level? You know, the basis is not local, so how do you do it? Yeah, there are things to explore for sure.
So, in the end, what is the definition of anomaly?
Yeah. So, I should be there. The precise statement is there are two definitions. Sorry. One definition is some kinematic obstruction of trivial states, things like just Lipschitz Mathis constraints.
That is, I list symmetries, and if I can't have a short-range entangled state.
Yeah, some global structure of your system that guarantees non-trivial state. The other definition is that obstruction of coupling your system to a gauge field in the same dimension, preserving gauge invariance. The two are approximately equal. Now there's a tons of subtlety in that approximate sign. But let's say if you're not super careful, they are roughly the same.
Naively, let's say if I have the toric code,
symmetry
x term and z term, it's non-trivial. Is it anomalous symmetry or?
Toric code does have anomalous symmetry. Actually, it does. It has an anomalous one-form symmetry.
Multiplying.
Yeah. So toric code has a E one-form symmetry and M one-form symmetry. They have some mutual anomaly. I mean. Okay, there it's, you can say it's a little bit overkill. The statement of anomaly is really.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so.
I see. So even for such examples, we can probably find. Okay, I see.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks.
Sure.
Yeah, I have a question related to the depths of the circuit.
Yeah.
So. I guess like you can have things which scales linearly, like with system size, logarithmically.
Yeah.
Do they correspond to different things?
Yeah. So when I say order one, that's technically a lie. If you're really careful, things should be order one should mean polylog. But polylog will be different from polynomial. So polylog and polynomial will be very different cases. For example, if I want to cook up a cat state, it has to be linear in L, nothing smaller. Yeah.
So no, like my question is like for the different scalings you.
Yeah.
Do they correspond to some qualitatively different systems?
Yeah, I think very. So order L would definitely be different than polylog, but you can ask, do you have something that? No, once you get to order L, it's you basically can get anything. So just from the depth alone is not enough to tell you exactly what type of state. Yeah, you have more. You need more refined measure. Yeah.
So the result you described. Very symmetry, translational symmetry of pure state implies long-range entanglement. Does anything like that go through for mixed states?
Yeah, that's it depends on how you phrase it. So if in your mixed state, every state, every pure state in your mixed state is a translation eigenstate with the same eigenvalue, and that eigenvalue is not one, then the same conclusion holds. But if they are eigenvalue of translation, but they have different eigenvalues, sorry, they're eigenstate of a translation, but they have different eigenvalues, then the statement doesn't hold. Right? It's the difference between so-called, it's essentially the difference between canonical and grand canonical ensemble. Do you fix the symmetry charge or not? If you do, the same conclusion will hold.
I see. So if you have a system with a degenerate ground state, a mixture of those guys, you would have the same result. That whole mixed state would be.
If the momentum is also degenerate, yeah. Very often they're not, but.
In the case of that tripartite
separability,
if you look at some tripartite measure of entanglement, does it have any specific behavior?
Yeah, that's the thing. There are things that will definitely give you a non-trivial result, but those things are not calculable. There are maybe a dozen or calculable measures. Almost all of them give you zero. The only one that gives you non-zero is non-zero only for very specific type of tripartition. Essentially something like B and C only contain one qubit or something. Beyond that, we haven't found any measure that works on this day. So the anomaly argument is actually the only thing we have now. It's kind of weird.
For that special one, do we know like how it scales in the thermodynamic?
If B and C has only one qubit, it's that thing is a constant. Yeah. You can scale A, keep B and C single qubit, that number is constant.
I have a question.
Yeah.
So in the Wassermann metal, there is this line of Dirac cones.
Yeah.
So I guess correlation functions must be quite anisotropic.
On the boundary, in the bulk, it's fine. Yeah.
In the boundary, there is.
Yeah, the boundary has the Fermi arc, so this direction and that direction is.
Does it mean that things decay fast away from this direction?
I think that it's more like in this direction, things more or less decouple. In this direction, it looks like some 1D chiral fermion. Yeah. So.
Any more questions? Thanks, Peter.
Thanks.